Welcome to this episode of the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum, the leading authority on cyber, information security, and risk management. I'm Tavia Gilbert, and I'm glad to welcome you back to another cutting-edge conversation tailored to CISOs, CTOs, CROs, and other global security pros. In every episode of ISF's media, Managing Director Steve Durbin speaks with rule breakers, collaborators, culture builders, and business creatives who manage their enterprises with vision, transparency, authenticity, and integrity. And he brings that conversation to you, your teams, and your partners. Today, Steve is in conversation with philosopher, author, and speaker Anders Inset. In this conversation, Steve and Anders discuss the importance of leaders engaging in what he calls a self-audit, having the strength and courage to get vulnerable, the importance of listening, and more. And now, Steve and Anders Inset.
Anders, thanks very much for joining me. I wanted to talk to you today about leadership and change. Some would say we've got too much of one and not enough of the other. I'm interested in your view on just that to start with. Have we got too little leadership and too much change going on in the world at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, change, that's a philosophical question if something changes at all. But I think the change is driven by a lot of external circumstances. And therefore, we react, we manage, we navigate. So I think the problem is that we have too little leadership. We have too little vision, guidance, actions taken, and actual thinking. So the change is relative, like it's abstract. So I think we need more leadership. I think then we can also take more control of the change and influence the world that we want to have.
I mean, leadership for me, it's all about empowerment. It's about empowering people. It's about empowering teams of individuals. But that requires, it seems to me, a fairly high degree of self-awareness, the need almost for self-audit from time to time. And very few people, it strikes me, are good at that. How do we become, do you think, as leaders, whether in a business context, in a sporting context, doesn't really matter, how do we become more self-aware, more vulnerable? How do we build that relationship?
Let me start off that self-audit. You know, we do all that financial audits and annual. We don't have the self-audit. Every person in a role, call it a manager or a boss or whatever, should have that. We don't know how we come across.
Right.
We don't have a mirror, you know? I do a lot of sessions with CEOs where I just talk about, you know, holding up a mirror and mirroring things that they've been doing for 20 years. So I think it's about getting that awareness, just putting a mirror in front of a person to see them from that particular light. Then we are, you know, smart enough to reflect on that. But again, there are also like quite a few things that you can train, of course, but you've been feeding into a system for 20, 30 years as a manager. It's hard to break out. So that's why you see that leadership is often something natural. If you look at sport, you can have a 19-year-old boy, if you say, I mean, be a captain of the national team or a soccer team to play in the Champions League, because that's something that evolves naturally. So for some people, obviously, it's easier to have that empathy, to put yourself in someone else's shoes, to be that person that you can talk to and to navigate and guide. But I think, you know, it should start with emphasizing on what kind of human being you want to become. If you want to lead, there are a lot of things that you can train, I believe.
It requires a degree of bravery as well, though, doesn't it? You talk about putting this mirror up in front, and for a lot of business leaders, for instance, it's taken them, to your point, 20, 30 years, whatever it is, to reach this sort of pinnacle of their career. And then what you're suggesting is perhaps that they just review all of that and expose a vulnerability that for some might be tough.
Right.
How do you get over that, though? How do you actually conquer that vulnerability, if you put it that way?
Yeah, because we define ourselves with power and not with strength, right? So we exploit power, but the actual strength is what we need today. We need the strength and the courage, as you said, to tap into that vulnerability. The things that we cannot grasp, where relations are created, where trust is created. A lot of people today also don't trust themselves. So we just live off trying to look important, trying to fill roles, trying to feed off of external impulses. And then the first thing that we need to do is to develop some kind of, you know, trust in yourself, because only then can you also trust others. If we neglect that, you know, we stop seeing when people are lying. We stop seeing when people are not trustworthy because we have left that skill with ourselves. So I think the first thing that we should do is to trust ourselves and tap into that actual feeling, to be honest to ourselves. We just lie too much, you know, and overplay the actual feelings, the intuition, what we feel when we are caught off guard. If we would be honest about that, to show that feeling and say, okay, this was awkward, or I don't know everything, then that strength will grow. And it's not about domination and power, but it's about actual strength under human beings. And I think that's a lot of the essence, to tap into those, you know, vulnerable moments and exploit them for what they are, because that's what makes us human. And that's what other people will feed off of.
But don't you think there's been something of a dehumanization, if I could put it that way, of the leader? You know, we think about technology. Everything is driven around technology. I'm using an iPad, you know, I'm talking to you with some pre-prepared questions on an iPad. We use our phones on a very regular basis, you know, averaging, what, 8, 9, 10, maybe more hours a day on the phone. Everything has a sense of urgency. And yet what you're suggesting is that somehow we disconnect from that, if I'm hearing you correctly, and take the time to really look much more and think much more. How do we create that space?
Steve, I have the feeling you are here. You know, we're talking to each other, right? But I see a lot of zombies. They're answering to answer and just reacting. And this is what technology, it's not just a dehumanization with leaders, it's the whole society that we have built. And this is that bubble, that framework, that we have to be something, to live up to something. That this is the hero society, where everything should be about feeding into individualism. And in particular here in Europe, I think we're further than that American dream of me first. And this collective approach, what we are doing now is talking to each other. There's a symbiosis of thoughts, and we're reflecting off of that and coming up with answers and things that we can talk about. And I think in Europe, we have a tradition of this collective that we understand that if we want to grow into being a leader, it's all about, you know, leading someone. We can only work together. And that requires that I want to listen to you and try to understand your background, your story, why you see the world how you see it. Only then can I reflect on my worldviews, meine Weltanschauung, as I say, and I can reconsider that. Or I can manifest it and say, okay, now I understand your point. Now I know exactly why I see the world as I do. And that requires, you know, listening in, being there. So it's not so much about just taking the time. It's also being conscious in the moment, listening with both ears. I refer to the giraffe language. You know, the giraffe has a long neck. So let it settle in. Let that, you know, thing that comes in here go down to the heart. You know, the giraffe has also a very big heart, before it gets back up to your mouth and you speak it out. So you should have that little moment to think about, okay, this is actually how I see it, not what I think would, you know, sound good to you. And I think that is the time that we need, just to settle in on that. What actually do you mean when you use that word, and how do I see that? And that's a lot to do with being conscious in the moment.
Mm. I think one of the biggest challenges, certainly, that I've found during the coronavirus pandemic, the lockdown particularly, has been that, you know, I certainly have been forced to communicate with people on screen. And when you talk about having the time to get to know people, to understand, to listen, very often you have to deal with just sheer exhaustion. There's always been this tendency to build back-to-back-to-back meetings because it's easy, right? It's simple. We just move on. I mean, how hard can it be? And one of the things that I certainly noticed that I missed the most, because I used to travel a tremendous amount, was that space. The time when, on an aeroplane, for instance, you can just tune out and you can just think about whatever it is that you're maybe where you're going, what it is that you're going to be doing. And I think a lot of people have found themselves in that position where there's this sense of grief. They've lost something. And they're really trying to recapture that because they know that they're missing it, but they don't know how now to get it back, because every day is constantly about the screen, about that form of communication. How do people deal with that at both a philosophical level? Mm. Because I think that's where it has to start. You have to think about it, right? And then at a very much more practical level, given that certainly in certain countries, you know, we're seeing returns to lockdowns, whether they be local, whether they be national, who knows?
Well, first of all, it's not just about getting onto the airplane and having that free space. It's like people are longing to get out and leave husband and children behind and get back to the office. I mean, people are starving and really looking forward to get up tired at 5 o'clock in the morning and going into the London rain and just forcing yourself into some kind of office that you can have that spontaneous moment at the coffee machine, right? Mm-hmm. The whole illusion of home office turns us from Zoom to zombies. Mm-hmm. It's that. It's very exhausting. And it takes all the tasks that you used to do and put them in the evening. And in a KPI-driven world, the productivity drops. And what do you do about that? You take all the tasks and put it in your spare time so you don't have that transparency. That's a very dangerous development. So what people will see is that for a short period of time, the illusion of increased productivity, well, in the long term, it turns out maybe the productivity is decreasing. And, you know, companies will want to have people back in some kind of office space. So that's, you know, that's a natural reaction of illusions of things happening very fast. We were on the path to home offices. Now it came rapidly. Now it's going to be a counter reaction. I think we need that particular thing, that spontaneous moment, those physical moments in order to, you know, even to survive. We cannot just be digital being sucked into those devices. And I see it as a very, very dangerous development amongst children. The addiction is going up. Porn addiction, gaming addiction, social media, just looking for likes and shares. That's how the outside world is defined. We have infantile boys with 20, hardcore addicted porn addicts who had never had a sexual relationship in their life. We have problems with particularly men, 30 to 40 years old. You can look at Scandinavia. They have a year and a half maternity leave as fathers. They're rich countries. Everything seems on the outside really, really good. But if you look behind the curtain, you will see they're taking antidepressant drugs. They don't have any friends anymore. They don't have any deep, meaningful talks with other guys. And that's a very big problem, which will lead to depression. It will lead to suicides and all of these things. And I think the first thing is, of course, to do the diagnosis and to see these critical issues for our society. And then I think coming back to your question is that we need to start the conversation. We need to talk about these topics in length, in depth, to find out how we can include people into the conversation, suck them out of the screen. I mean, it's basically taking all the measurements to fight drug addicts and to figure out how to get meaning back in life when you have run into some kind of addiction. We are all driven by recommendation engines. We are already, even though the artificial intelligence is fairly simple at times, we are all driven by it. And recognizing that you have a problem as a human being, that's the first step. And it starts with the family. It starts with the time that you, you know, spend with your children, with your wife, your spouse. That's the beginning. And I think we all have to just, you know, see that we do have some issues. And this is not going in a good place. And that's the first step. And I think then the next step would be to start an honest dialogue about these issues.
It's interesting you raise this whole subject of addiction. I remember some, probably about 12 months ago now, when Tavia, my producer for the podcast series that we're running at the moment, and I were talking about different themes. We talked about trying to find a family or a series of families that we could actually track, if you like, when they were going out to see the level of usage that they made of technology when they were just out for dinner. It proved incredibly difficult to find anybody who was willing to participate in that experiment for a variety of reasons. There was some fear about what they might discover. There was the fear of intrusion. And so it struck me at that point that we're trying to find a way of coexistence with technology that, in the ideal world, will take the benefits of technology, apply them to the way in which we as humans operate. And yet that's exceptionally difficult to do because, to your point earlier, we're getting sucked into it. So my question really is, how do we manage to coexist, get the best from technology without it overcoming and destroying some of the more human elements that are so essential to what it is that we actually do?
By defining that, you always have that debate on saying that technology, we're not going to be a crane, we don't have to lift heavy things and all that. Now the human being can do the essential stuff. So what is the essential stuff, right? What is it that we value, really? And I think if we don't define that, you know, technology doesn't have a soul or a purpose. It's not good or bad. It just is. It's very efficient. It could be radical in its outcome. But you see, we don't define a goal. When we say digital transformation, what the hell are we transforming into? Mm-hmm. And we don't define what is enough, what do we want to achieve. So the best of technology, what would that be? You know, what kind of problems should it solve? So I think it comes down to having a balance in life. Of course, there's no equilibrium or no perfect balance, but we talk about the work-life balance and so on and so forth, but there is just a life-life balance. And I think during the lockdown, a lot of people discovered like the ordinary things like nature, you know, the deep ecology of the Norwegian philosopher Arne Næss, and just, you know, the things that are so special. I was on an island off the Lofoten writing on my next book, and I go outside and you can listen to the silence. So that's just a moment where you say that this is the most wonderful thing in life. It's so quiet, you hear the silence. And that's where you know you are conscious. You don't need meditation or any spiritual practices. You just realize that you are alive, you're a human being. Mm-hmm. And I think that balance, we have left that balance. We're just trying to achieve some unreachable goals because the role models and the illusions of heroes and what have you, not what we want to have. More materialism, more possession. And during, you know, the lockdown, we say, okay, maybe it's exhausting to own all this stuff, right? Do we need all this? Maybe there are other things. And I don't think it was enough. It wasn't radical enough for that change, but it gave us a sense of being, a sense of purpose. And I think the best way to do it is to find time and to practice it. So as bad as it sounds, there should be some off-phone moments with the family where we leave it behind. I think there was a Netflix documentary called The Social Dilemma back a couple of months ago that described this, you know, what we all know really well. And I think the way forward is, as I said before, is to first realize that we have an issue and then to figure out what are the things that we can do to solve it. If we actually want to solve it, then we'll find ways. Be it through Eastern philosophy, be it through just, you know, accepting the fact that we have a family and we love our closest ones. We will figure it out. But the first part is getting out of that reaction mode, mm-hmm. getting out of that, you know, doing, just reacting to impulses and seeing, oh my, I have a problem. And then trying to figure out what is my solution. It's certainly different to you than it is to myself. But that's why we want to have a balance between the outside-driven world and the inside world. And we have neglected the fact that we have an inside world, that there is something that makes us human. And I think we need to get that in some kind of balance or to strive for balance.
So let me put that into a business context then. So because there are probably some business leaders listening to this, I hope there are, and they're sitting there probably thinking to themselves, okay, I get that. I get it in the personal environment, perhaps in the family and so on. But I'm, at the end of the day, I'm trying to run a business. How can I take some of those things and bring them into the business world, make them come alive for the people that work with me in trying to meet the objectives that we've got, to try to keep the lights on, to feed people, all of those things. What's the sort of the key elements of advice that we can give those people who are perhaps struggling with how to go forward?
Well, the first thing that I do, Steve, is that I ask this person, why does that contradict with your business goals? Mm-hmm. Let's try to work on that, right? And then that's the same thing as saying, okay, you know, being profitable is not contradictory to being sustainable today.
Right?
Being a human being in the organization, coping with people, does not make you less profitable. Acting on a role, being a robot, being a jerk, you know, that does not make your numbers go bad. There is no failure in business just because you're nice, just because you're a human being, just that to show that you're vulnerable. And I strongly believe that. And in fact, it shows that it's the opposite. It's a contradictory. You know, it's if you start to take care of your people, they don't join you for the money, they will leave you for the money. Mm-hmm. If they join you for the realness, the essence of your vision, the problem you want to solve, they will stick with you through bad times, right? So I think there is no problem at all It's just about the courage to do so. And I meet a lot of managers. I used to be a hardcore capitalist. I lived in this model, feeding off the outside world. I've sat in on so many meetings. I've consulted with many Fortune 500 companies. And I see the same all over the place, that now a lot of these senior executives are starting to ask themselves this question, where they don't just reduce their wealth to the KPIs or their bank accounts, but they're asking themselves these philosophical questions, you know. What is this? Is this it? Is this what I wanted to do? And I think combining that, the essence, does not make your company less profitable. And that said, if you don't want to feel it, at least you should rationally understand that young people will not join you if you're a jerk, right? They are now back to a position, a lot of these young people, where they come self-confident into the organization and want to play along. They want and need mentors, of course, some extent, but they want to be treated as a human being, as a person, and not as a number or whatever, right? And I think that is where we now exploit the resources of the human beings. You know, HR, human resources. Mm-hmm. No, that's not it. It's human reason. It's human recognition. It's human relationships. The R is just incorrect, right? It's not exploiting human resources. And I think, you know, if you can get into that potential, most likely, as a business leader, you will do better off. That's my bet. So I think, you know, if you want to tap into it, you will feel it. If you don't, just accept the fact that no organization in future will not work and not get people if they're not working for a circular economy, they're not sustainable, and they don't treat their human beings, the other people in the organization, in a decent way. Those are the basic facts that people want to work for you. So I think it's a good thing to spend some time to think about it, at least. Also for the leaders that don't accept it.
Some great insights there. Anders Inter, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We hope the conversation with Anders Inter inspires you to listen more closely to silence, to have the courage to look in the mirror and engage in your own self-audit, and to consider where you can allow more vulnerability and empathy in your life and your work. In our next episode, Steve will be in conversation with Dr. Hannah Fry, a researcher in the patterns of human behavior, particularly behavior in an urban setting. In this conversation, Steve and Hannah discuss the challenge and imperative of communicating across demographics with simplicity and clarity, the power of storytelling, the moral tensions inherent in data mining, and more. Here's a preview of that conversation.
Really, the tension here, right, is that there is this often conflicting battle between innovation, between wanting to understand how people work, wanting to improve science and medicine, wanting to get a better data-driven and evidence-based view of the world and of our future. And that is often in conflict with the rights of an individual and the privacy that I think we should all be well entitled to.
We look forward to bringing you the full interview. In the meantime, we invite you to tune into our catalog of video and podcast episodes, all of which you can find at securityforum.org. If you feel like today's conversation was of value, you can subscribe to the audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd be so grateful if you'd recommend us. Growing our subscriber numbers helps us reach new audiences and helps us continue to bring you these timely discussions. You can always join in the conversation on our LinkedIn page at linkedin.com/company/information-security-forum, or get in touch directly through our website, where you can also download ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like these. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert. Music by Alexander Filipiak. Assistant producer, Katie Flood. Mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.